Welcome to Explain to Shane. I'm your host, Shane Tews at the American Enterprise Institute. On this podcast, I interview tech industry experts to explain how the apps, services, and structures of today's information technology system work and how they shape our social and economic life.
There's an unspoken issue around information technology systems referred to as technical debt. It is estimated to cost the U.S. $2.4 trillion annually, and assessments believe the expense to manage the issue would weigh in around $1.5 trillion to fix the ongoing technical costs. Technical debt refers to the accumulation of software quick fixes, outdated hardware systems, and inefficient legacy code in IT systems. Technical debt creates security vulnerabilities, barriers to innovation, system failures, and slows down the development of new system operations. The problem has parallels with the national debt and aging physical infrastructure. Fixing technical debt requires management to empower its IT system teams to focus on managing existing systems more robust and secure, while AI can help make the software better by finding and fixing mistakes in the code. Older software may be inhibited by AI that needs to be used carefully when cleaning up and improving current code, or it might make the problem of some legacy systems worse. My guest today is Ken Silva. Ken has over 30 years of experience in technology, telecommunications, and cybersecurity businesses. He is well known for the work he has done as a chief technology officer and as a chief security officer, as well as a chief scientific officer for multiple tech companies. Before working in the enterprise space, Ken was technical director with the National Security Agency for 10 years. He also served in the United States Air Force for 10 years. Ken has participated in the National Infrastructure Protection Center, the White House ISP Security Panel, the ICANN Network Operations Security Working Group, the Network Reliability and Interoperability Council, and the President's National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee. Ken has also taught courses at the National Cryptological School. I hope you enjoy this conversation about the challenges of our sunk costs in IT infrastructure and the need to manage our technical debt. Ken, thank you for being a guest today on Explain to Shane. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple months ago about technical debt, and it reminded me of you and I talking over Christmas about some of the work you've been doing on trying to help bigger legacy enterprises figure out what they did and didn't need to be keeping around with their equipment, especially as we're moving towards so many different things with either a combination of 5G, network virtualization, software-defined networking. And there's a lot of legacy stuff that still sticks around, but it costs a lot of money to keep it going. And that's what this article is about. So I really appreciate you being on today to talk about this. So let's just start with the whole concept of technical debt. Like, the numbers that were in this article said that they think an estimated cost is about $2.41 trillion annually. And that's mostly enterprises that maybe governments. I need to kind of dig into that. But is this problem as big as the Wall Street Journal says it is?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but I would suspect maybe that it's even bigger than that. It's probably close to unmeasurable because every organization has some level of technical debt or legacy challenges that they have to deal with. Every organization does.
So give us some real world examples of how technical debt causes, not only just is it a cost, but it also causes operational problems, disruptions, and then security breaches.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that you could tie most modern security breaches to some level of technical debt, of not having software that's patched, not having libraries that are patched, not having bugs that have been loopholes that have been in disrepair in your software for some amount of time. The fact of the matter is that, you know, engineering teams don't get brownie points for fixing bugs. They get brownie points for adding features. Just as an example, last year, an unpatched vulnerability in Cisco devices compromised more than 40,000 Cisco devices. And Cisco, you know, is probably the top brand in networking in the world, not just in the U.S. So, you know, this affects everyone. And by the way, Cisco had actually fixed this bug, but the number of organizations that had actually deployed it was a lot less than we had hoped.
Yeah, that's so. I read a lot, and there was one in Microsoft what in December, January. That the problem is it's not they put the fix out there, but you can't always promote or make sure that everyone that has the problem knows they have the problem and are fixing the problem. That seems to be a major problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, technical debt means a lot to a lot of different things to different people. You know, to product development as an example, you know, to your product development team, they view technical debt as features that are yet to be added or features or bugs in your software that have yet to been added. If you look at an operational or a DevOps team, you know, they'll look at that more as libraries that have yet to be patched or languages that have yet to be updated.
Oh, that's interesting. So how do you get management to the previous example saying they may or may not know, you know, and again, always saying the challenge of the IT guys trying to get the C-suites example, I talk about that a lot on this podcast, is how do we get the management to be convinced to allocate resources towards fixing, as you said, bugs? Like they don't get kudos for that, especially if it's not going to yield immediate tangible results.
Yeah, that's a very good question, Shane. This has been a challenge that we've had with security in general. You know, 10 years ago, we were talking about how do we get the C-suite's attention on security, cybersecurity, and those types of issues. And, you know, frankly, the only way we got their attention was through audits and compliance. It would be unfortunate to have to go down that path. But I think ultimately that's where compliance is headed, is that they're going to start looking at technical debt and saying, hey, wait a minute, you have a lot of unpatched libraries here or a lot of libraries that aren't supported anymore. You know, how is your business going to stay functioning if this library goes away or can't even be loaded on an operating system anymore?
Yeah, and languages that computers no longer want to speak, especially with AI coming on. They're like, we don't need to be doing that anymore. So do we need outside intervention? You mentioned the audits for the older, more critical organizations, such as financial institutions, to ensure that they're staying within regulatory code. Or do we have market forces that you think bring these industry players in line?
Well, so far, the market forces have been the dominant lead in this. And I think to a large degree, they've kind of helped in that process. But I mean, there are still legacy banks out there that are running on, you know, software languages that haven't been used in decades. You know, there's always that saying that it's, you know, too big to fail. There's also such a thing as too big to fix. And companies have had to just, you know, literally just wipe the slate clean and start over again. And that's a costly and expensive process. You know, you can deal with a toothache as a filling today, or you can wait a little while and it'd be a root canal.
Right. So if you are, like, you worked recently with a company that was, they acquired a lot of old equipment. And of course, part of the challenge here is not knowing how long you need to keep data, you know, because of data regulations are still not, you know, symmetrical in most places. So, you know, like maybe you're holding on to things for 5, 6, 7 years and they're really just kind of a repository. But there also could be challenges that those legacy systems being online at a certain server location are causing you, either because of a geolocation or the fact that they're just running again on like old systems that, you know, haven't been patched. So they're always that inflection point of vulnerability. Would you just, it sounded to me when you and I were talking about this, it's like you almost just wanted to like rip the plug out of some of these places and see if they go dark, it would have caused a problem.
Well, in fact, many companies have actually done that, where they've said, look, I don't know what this is for. No one in the company today knows what this server's for or knows what this storage is for. And literally have had to say, look, let's just turn it off and see who screams. And sadly, there's a lot of that goes on today. It is probably one of the more prevalent ways that, you know, look, there's just a lot of turnover in technical staff, and so much of what has been done in an infrastructure is bespoke, right? You started off as a small team of people who developed monitoring capabilities or management capabilities for For your product. And it grew and sort of took on a life of its own and became an internal product of its own. And then over time, the key developers of that or the key maintainers of that have all disappeared. And now no one knows how it works, and you just sit and hope and keep your fingers crossed that it doesn't break. And by the way, I think that this is going to...
I thought those people were called consultants. You just leave them on the speed dials. You're like, can you explain to me this line 7 here? Do we need to keep that?
Well, even the consultants can't tell you what happened. What they'll tell you to do or tell you how you got here. The only thing that they'll tell you to do is, don't delete it. Just turn it off for a while and see what happens. Now, look, I'm oversimplifying it. That's not usually what happens right away, but ultimately, all too often, that's where things wind up, is that no one can explain how these servers were stood up. And by the way, cloud complicates this immensely, because what used to take weeks or even months to stand up 100 servers in a data center now takes 5 minutes in a cloud environment. So, you get well-meaning people who are standing infrastructure up, and they stand it up and they get it working, and then they just leave it alone and it just stays there, but no one knows how it got there. There's no, unless you build processes internally and strictly around how servers get stood up, software gets added to those servers, et cetera. But, interestingly enough, the industry has sort of gone in the opposite direction. The DevOps concept was more about having the people who write the code deploy the code to support the code. And, so you do sort of land in one place that's that one throat to choke if something goes wrong. But at the same time, they make up their own processes that support their own needs in many cases.
So that gets to a question you were kind of answering for me, which is how organizations strike that balance between wanting to be innovative and then having maybe the regulatory obligations to maintain that robust, secure IT infrastructure that may be full of legacy stuff they really don't need, but they've got an albatross around their neck.
Yeah, in some cases, they don't even know if they need it or not. In a lot of cases, they don't know if they need it or not. Or they have it, they need it, and don't even know if it's working properly. So the balance, I think, is unique to each organization. What works for my organization may not work for your organization, but I think being conscious of the fact that you have to deal with these things and be conscious that you have to ask yourself, and maybe this is part of the internal audit process, is, what happens if this thing I rely on goes away? Now, those are things you can sort of look at internally and say, okay, I can work around that, or I'll build around that so that I don't rely on that so much. But your customers also can hold you back. At a startup I worked at, we had a product that worked with a browser. It worked with Internet Explorer for a long time. In fact, that was our first offering. And then Microsoft had stated that they were no longer going to support Internet Explorer, that Edge was the future for them, that Internet Explorer was going to fade into the sunset. And so we were going to go with it. We were going to, we said, hey, look, we're going to support Edge. We're not going to support Internet Explorer anymore. And so we notified our customers that, hey, guess what? Our product's not going to work with Internet Explorer anymore, and you need to upgrade to Microsoft Edge to continue to use our product. Our largest customer came back and said, look, we have hundreds of thousands of desktops that are running Internet Explorer, and it will take us years to update all of those, and so you need to continue to support Internet Explorer. So even in our own internal audit processes, we had to quantify what our risk was in continuing to support these legacy libraries in Internet Explorer, and not moving on away from those risky libraries that even Microsoft has said, look, we don't want to support anymore. So sometimes your customers can drive you to support things in ways that you would rather not do, in a less secure way.
Yeah, it's a good thing you asked your client before you just move forward. Like, hey, we're going to do the right thing. It turned out may not be so right. I was reading an article in the Register. It's one of my favorite reads. That was talking over the weekend about this guy. I think they just call him Monty. He said that he was having a Marie Kondo moment, and he wanted to clean up the systems in this enterprise. And so he said after each update, the OS popped up and reminded him there was unused packages and he'd like to uninstall them. He said since he was a tidy person, he decided he'd do this because he thought he needed the local disk space. And then all of a sudden, it just took off and started deleting all unused packages containing obscure names. And he accidentally, knocked the entire system off for the weekend, but he was exhausted, so he went home.
Oh, no.
But then it turned out somebody else did something even worse, so the system went down, and he didn't get blamed for it, and then he was able to fix it on Monday when he came in.
Oh, my. You know, that happens a lot. Usually the thing that you think is going to do the least harm does the most harm, and it always happens on a Friday afternoon.
Oh, it's always that click, you get so used to they're the push through buttons. And then just as you hit it, you're like, no, but you can't physically stop your finger from hitting it. And you're like, I don't know how I get that back, damn it.
Yeah. But there are so many components that our software rely on that there's just so many libraries in the operating system and that are used in the programming languages, that any one of them could change at any time and cause problems. You know, something as simple that's been around for really for a very long time is secure sockets layer. You know, the OpenSSL library has been around for a very long time. But there have been cases where just subtle changes to that library have broken things in legacy software. And by the way, when I say legacy software, I mean like just 6 months ago kind of software. It's imperative that people not just blindly upgrade, but at the same time that they do have to upgrade at some point. And, you know, we've tried to adopt a principle I have anyways that try to rely on someone else as little as possible, just simply because you don't want to tie yourself to something you can't get out of. I mean, an example is a cloud provider. For storage, for networking, and for compute, it's fairly straightforward. You know, you can load your own operating systems on there, you can set the network up the way that you want, and you can store things, for the most part, the way that you want. But when you start using the individual services that they offer and APIs that they offer, those vary from one cloud provider to the next. And so as your infrastructure starts to grow and you rely on those various APIs, your cloud provider could decide to make changes to those, or you could decide that you want to make changes but can't because you're tied to that cloud provider forever. Because you're using so much of their infrastructure, and that's by design, by the way. Their design is to make life easy for you, but their technical debt now becomes your technical debt.
Right, and all the subscription model. I mean, it's like once you're in, you're just sucked in. You're like, you better choose well. Actually, I choose them all, which is silly because I don't have that much information to share. But I'm like, everybody gets to keep my photos. Everyone, just in case one of you goes down. But you bring up another good point that our life has become much more about apps. When you're talking about the APIs, we push a button, and for the end user, you really don't know what's behind it, right? I mean, your IT team may tell you not to put certain things on. We certainly have had DHS telling people in the government space and consumers who will listen to say, really think about what you do before you put you put something on to your device, especially your mobile device, right? Because that's going to be more app driven. And now we're challenged with Europe coming out with the Digital Markets Act and saying, well, we think you should have everything. You should stop putting these guardrails around, in this case, like the Apple App Store. And we're seeing more reasons to have an app store. Like, I was talking to a drone company the other day that is, planning on building a drone app store. And I was like, well, you sure certainly would like the drone app store to know what the security measures are of the apps that they make available to their customers, right? But according to the Europeans, they're taking away that security by design by their regulation. And so we're having a lot of silliness I think, in the government space. We're trying to keep the U.S. government from doing it. The people that are security-minded are saying all the right things. The challenge is sometimes the security-minded and the regulators are not in the same building, let alone the same camp. So what are your thoughts as somebody who's spent a lot of time in this space? How do you talk them into understanding the importance of security?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We have spent a lot of time doing that. There's merits to both sides of the argument, right? Apple is very justified in what they're trying to do. They're trying to create an ecosystem that is secure across all of their devices, across all of their ecosystem, if you will. And individual users are saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, I want to be able to install what I want to be able to install, and I don't want you to control it. So there's always been this wrestling match between the end user's desire to do what they want and, you know, the hardware and software manufacturers' desire to have some control over what is and isn't on the devices. This is, you know, it's a storied history for sure, because Apple has for a very long time strictly controlled what can and can't be installed on their devices, very strictly controlled it. With good reason, because, you know, when people have had, you know, we'll call them jailbroken phones or devices, there have been instances where bad stuff has happened. And I think so many cases of with Android. But Android does give you sort of the option to say, look, I want to restrict it, but I also want, I'm willing to take the risk. Let me unlock it.
Yeah.
So I think Android may have found, you know, a balance there if they want. But as enterprises want to use, the reality is that we're in a bring your own device world, whether you're bringing your own device or not, right? You're taking the devices that are given to you by your company home with you every day, and you're attaching them to your network at home or to the Starbucks network or what have you. So the mere fact that you're hooking it to another network is placing it at some risk that, you know, we never would have taken 15 years ago. But we take those risks today. And so I think most enterprises are happy to have very strict control over what can and can't be installed on the devices, but end users don't seem to feel that way. So
I think a lot of these don't see it. I mean, they love having the end result, but they just don't understand the underpinning of what's going on. Hopefully we're able to do some self-healing along the way there. So with the advent, you mentioned cloud, which, you know, for a long time, cloud felt free to people. It's starting to have a little bit more of an expense. And, you know, with artificial intelligence using so much more energy and compute, but that also gives us that kind of, you know, speed of light. Will we be able to maybe just kind of leapfrog over some of the current challenges we have with the systems and just call bankruptcy on the old systems?
Well, that's an interesting thought. that kind of happens sometimes as it is, where you get these small players that are nimble and they can enter the market without all the encumbrances of the previous generation, right? So what happens is that the big fish sort of get harpooned and pulled out of the water anyways because the little fish came in. But I'll tell you, the more painful place where that tends to happen is, let's say you become a medium-sized enterprise. You know, you're a growing company. You've done some good work. You've been around half a dozen or maybe 10 years. And, you know, you're starting to think, do I want to go public or do I want to, you know, maybe look at a merger or an acquisition? What's happening, unfortunately, and this has been happening for years, And I've seen it many times, where when your goal is to be acquired and you become acquired, the acquiring company looks at your tech and says, I can't deal with this, and winds up just shutting down what you've been working on for, you know, all those years, because they just can't deal with it. Because a fresh set of eyes on some of these problems look like they're bigger than they really are. And I've seen it too many times, where a company with a great technology gets acquired and the acquiring company just looks at it afterwards and says, I can't deal with this. I can't integrate it. It doesn't use a language we're familiar with or that we use. I don't have any developers that know COBOL or Fortran anymore. So, by the way, we acquired a company at one of my companies that did use COBOL, very old. But anyways, they just write it off. And it's a shame because so many good technologies just – because of all the quick fixes and patches that were done, they just look at it and say, look, I can't deal with this. I can't work with it. And so it gets shelved. The intellectual property tends to get absorbed into something else, and then you never see it again. Look, a lot of companies, particularly when they're small, say, look, I don't want my developers working on anything that doesn't contribute to the intellectual property of my company. So in other words, if there's open source out there, then I want to use that first. And that's a noble goal, and I think it's a good thought to start with. But also remember that someday that open source project may go away or may change in a way you can't adapt to, and you're stuck. But with AI, oddly enough, there's this artificial intelligence framework called Ray. Which is an artificial intelligence framework, which was actually compromised and used to hijack other resources on the network where the artificial intelligence was. So
glad to know that. I would say if we could just get these bad guys to figure out the right price point to make them good guys, because they're so smart and they know how to do things for a lot of money the wrong direction so quickly.
Well, I have a lot of hope for AI. I really do. Right now, AI can create shells of code that, it's probably not production ready code, but my hope is that it will be able to look through your environment, in near real time and spot areas that you need to focus on and help guide you through that transition process. Sometimes we call technical debt just stuff where we just didn't get to it and we always wanted to do it. I'll give you an example of one that was that turned out to be more serious than we thought. Amazon has its own flavor of Linux that it uses, okay, and it's very good, and they keep it up to date, and it's security patches and all those sorts of things. But they're now in 2022 or 2024, they decided to, we need our next generation of that. And so they did it. But the problem was that there were people still on the first iteration that couldn't get off of the first iteration to the second iteration. And now we're on the third iteration of it. And so, people had always meant to say, hey, look, let's move to AL2. It turns out they never got on to AL2. And they're stuck. And guess what? AL1 isn't supported anymore. So now they're kind of freaking out. So they said, hey, I know what we'll do. We'll go to containers. And so we'll start using Kubernetes. And then they find out that they can't migrate to Kubernetes either because their application was never really developed for containerization. And they find out that everything doesn't fit in a container nicely.
It's one of those conversations I have with my older relatives when they show up with their sad little iPad that somehow was just supported enough. And I'm like, let's just go to the Apple Store.
But I'll tell you where I have some hope. And that is that over the last 2-3 years, maybe even 4 years, the conversations in sprints, around agile development and those sorts of things are now starting to highlight technical debt. What are the things we need to focus on? What are the libraries we need to start to adopt? It's a part of the day-to-day conversation now with the CTO and with product management that I think is getting a level of attention. Look, if you had said this 5 years ago or 6 years ago, most of the people in the room wouldn't even know what you're talking about. Now I think it's a pretty common term that's used throughout the software engineering world. And I think you're starting to see these things get built into sprint cadences and those sorts of things. So I'm optimistic that For every regulation, there's an accident that happened before it, you know. And by the way, this isn't just in the software industry. I mean, you look at any industry, and those legacy systems are hard to adapt to new technology. You see it in the automotive industry. You know, you got a 100-plus-year-old industry that just can't adapt to the new technology, and they're paying a price for it now. You know, how much it costs to do that. Where you get some small company, you know, like a Rivian or a Tesla or someone like that, they can parachute in and build it from scratch, and all of a sudden they can do things pretty fast. But someday they'll be the legacy system.
Yep. Well, I'm gonna leave this on the note of optimism. I'm excited. I think that there's going to be a lot of interesting things. There's going to be, and think about it as like, it's like the DVD players or the VCRs that, you know, some people just insist, they get excited. You give them a box of things. They're like, I'm going to keep that going. You're like, good on you. But there's the cost of it is what really kind of got me fascinated by it. Cause I was like, you know, there just seems like there's one point where you just have to say, just keep moving on, you know, and what do you do to like kind of take that previous cost, understand it sunk, and you know, don't have tears over it, but move forward. So, Ken, thank you very much for this conversation today. It's been enlightening, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Yep, glad. Good to talk to you, Shane. Always is.
Thanks for being a guest today on Explain to Shane.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Explain to Shane. For more episodes, subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred listening platform. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues to tune in. We'll see you on the next episode of Explain to Shane.